Welcome to Intelligence Community Agency in Focus, sponsored by Leidos.
From security background checks to new and novel ways of dealing with insider threats, the intelligence community must deal with the issues surrounding cleared people. And oddly, the five-year-old Office of Personnel Management data breach continues to cast a shadow over all federal cyber efforts, even those in the IC. Sina Begley is Associate Director of the Cyber and Intelligence Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. I spoke with her about these and other issues in the intelligence community.
It impacts a lot about how the government and those in the national security field think about how employees are vetted, but how their information is protected to ensure that that very kind of deeply personal and detailed information is not divulged to an adversary, and an adversary can't get access to it through something like a breach or a cyber attack or anything like that. So it's concerning looking forward to try to ensure better protection of employee data and especially background investigation data. But just looking back, those risks still exist. The adversary that took the information still has that information, and a lot of that information is permanent, unchanging information about 20 million individuals who are responsible for safeguarding America's secrets. And so the threat and the challenge with those individuals is still very much ongoing. And then you got to think about hoping that the adversary that does have the information appropriately safeguards it so other bad actors don't get that detailed information about some of our custodians of America's secrets.
And has that data ever been found for sale on the dark web? I know early on investigators were looking for it. And basically, have there been any effects from it other than reputational for OPM and some cost? But have there been any real effects that anyone is aware of?
To my knowledge, no. Again, publicly at least. So open reporting. I'm not aware of any selling of that information on the dark web. So that's good news. But it's also hard to determine where information is coming from, right? Some of this information is information that other vetting entities have, right? Like consumer reporting agencies and that kind of thing. So trying to narrow down where information about individuals comes from is not always the easiest thing to do. And you have quite a number of people here in the OPM data breach. For example, I'll use myself as an example. I was part of both breaches of the OPM data, but I have also been a part of any number of breaches of consumer reporting agencies and, email and you name it. I've gotten all sorts of notifications and commercial, companies that have data. So trying to narrow down where that information comes from, I think, is a challenge. But I haven't heard from the government or any sort of outside person pointing to, here's this information that is most definitely from the data breach at this point. And in, from my optic, that is good news because, again, there is information in that, not sort of about individuals. There's personally identifiable information. There are those things that you can find in other places from other breaches. But in the government's data, they're included things like background investigator notes, like very kind of detailed information about your network and the people that you know. Some that might be apparent in social media, so you might be able to find that in that way, but some that might not be readily apparent by any of the normal kind of accessible checks or repositories of information.
We're speaking with Sina Begley. She's Associate Director of the Cyber and Intelligence Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. And looking at the larger issue of data breaches, to what extent in your experience and in your research and in your work in the federal government, for that matter, are these types of breaches connected with someone inside? Is it possible to know even? Because sometimes it seems that with a large breach, someone had to be involved that would point people to where to go. But we don't know for sure.
Yeah, you don't know for sure. Oftentimes what will happen is not that a person, so when you're talking about like a cyber breach like this, right, versus someone taking information, physically removing it, and then defaulting.
Correct.
Right? So
yes.
In this case, right. So in this case, when you're talking about cyber data, the premise of this particular one was a compromised contractor credential, right? So it wasn't someone knowingly providing that, but it was, the in was using someone's information that they were able to get access to. It's not dissimilar to any kind of like phishing attack where someone will click on a link, they get an email, click on a link, you know, type in a username and password, and suddenly all their account information is available to that actor. It would obviously have much bigger implications and ramifications for that, but most of these aren't insiders saying, here's how you find, here's how you navigate our file structure. It's a bad actor who knows how to navigate once they get inside and they can just sort of read it. You know, like we read a book, someone who has those kinds of skills is able to just read that structure and be able to figure out where to find information, especially if they're able to be in there for a long period of time, which in this case, these actors were in that data and information undetected for more than a year. So particularly concerning how much, you know, they were able to really get a sense of how that happened. On the other side of what I was alluding to, there's the other piece of things, which is not a cyber attack or cyber breach, but it's someone taking the information and divulging it, right? That kind of insider threat. So, you know, Edward Snowden obviously being an example of that, which I dealt with, you know, that whole sort of scenario when I was at the National Security Council staff. Chelsea Manning being another one, you know, people that have access to information and then divulging or sharing it to either, you know, the public or the press, or in some cases, of course, to an adversary, a foreign government. And then that becomes espionage, you know, in a different way.
Yeah. And as serious as that breach was, I still wonder why Edward Snowden himself wasn't dealt with more harshly. Because didn't that seem like, yes, maybe the NSA shouldn't have had that surveillance program, but that's really a decision that should be made by lawmakers working with the intelligence community and working with input from experts in the public, but not something because it was exposed, then we have a change in national policy.
Yeah, I mean, there were big changes that were made. There was, you know, that whole scenario, as I'm sure you know, is quite a complicated one. But on one hand, as far as like dealing with the you know, accused for taking the information and doing what they did, I mean, some of that was just the circumstances of, you know, the government has certainly indicted him. They certainly, you know, would like to prosecute, but can't get access, you know, to him to be able to do that at this juncture. So it's outstanding. It's still there. But again, being able to actually do something because he has refuge, you know, in Russia and is inaccessible to sort of prosecute on that front. But yeah, as far as the information and what happened, I mean, there were sort of the domestic pieces that were, you know, revealed in the media reporting and the leaks that came from the data that Edward Snowden is accused of taking. But then there were also just, you know, any number of international programs and, you know, some had sensitivity on, you know, people being concerned about civilian individual data, personal privacy and intelligence collection, some having to do with, you know, partner nations concerned about what intelligence collection was happening, but some having to do with, you know, real robust programs intended to either, you know, provide force protection or provide security, like, you know, counterterrorism operations, and those are sort of intelligence programs that the concern was fact of those programs, where collection's happening, what type of collection was happening, then resulted in changes of individuals and how they communicated. And so that's something that, you know, national security leaders at the time were raising as one of the real implications that happened. Just like anything, over time, intelligence collection is going to change. It's the intelligence community's job to change the way that it does things. So if an adversary changes, it's the intelligence community's job to figure out, you know, how to continue to get access to information about them. So that in the end is, you know, sort of what happened over time when intelligence collection had to change the way that it did collection or who it was looking at or how it was targeting information because an adversary changed the way they were communicating because they might have found out about how that was happening. So that becomes sort of a cat and mouse that always occurs. But these big capabilities, the concern was that divulging that information is a big investment challenge as well, right? So it's not only a national security challenge, but you also have to figure out other ways to be able to get information to better secure the nation.
That's Sina Begley, Associate Director of the Cyber and Intelligence Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. We'll have more of the interview after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
From idea to reality, innovation is at the heart of mission success. At Leidos, we're helping our customers transform vast amounts of data into actionable intelligence. Leidos is number one on the Washington Technology Top 100, bringing unrivaled talent to bear on the intelligence community's critical missions through our data analytics, all-source analysis, linguistics, agile and sec DevOps, and advanced AI/ML that allows you to see the full picture faster. At Leidos, the important work never stops. Visit leidos.com/intel to learn how.
Welcome back to my interview with Sina Begley, Associate Director of the Cyber and Intelligence Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. So it seems then that there's really several classes of insider threat. There is this plain naive that leave the wrong passwords in place for administrator rights or click on that phishing email. Then there are the messianics like Edward Snowden that decide upon themselves that they know what's best in public policy, et cetera, and go ahead and then run off to Russia. Then there is the malfeasance of the type that would do what Snowden did, but in return take a Trader Joe's grocery bag full of $100 bills under a park bench somewhere and go home with it. So have I missed any?
I think so. I mean, those are the big ones. I mean, when you think about unauthorized disclosures, right? So leakers, spies, and general insider threats. I think what I would add is the physical threat, right? We've had some of those where you're talking about just sort of the data, but then there's some people that become that threat to the actual physical individuals, and we've had that happen in a couple of cases. All of this, of course, being related to, you know, security clearance vetting and who do we trust and how do we know they can be trusted, not just when they first get their clearance, but on a consistent and reliable way as they continue to have access to this very sensitive information. So I would just add on the insider threat, your right for information. I think that covers the broad spectrum of it. But then there's physical security, both of the information and of the individuals, where we have had a number of scenarios where, you know, people have actually been physically harmed or killed because of actions taken by an insider who had access to them physically and no longer could be trusted, but the government didn't detect that ahead of time.
Yeah, so that gets us into the idea of background investigations, security clearance, and the whole idea of continuous monitoring of people. And where is this all going? Because it seems like the government has a great vision for continuously clearing people or continuously following them once they are cleared, but they're far from having it operational.
Yeah, it does. I mean, actually, they've made big, lots of progress, right? So, for instance, when I was working at the National Security Council in 2013 and 2014, dealing with the Edward Snowden disclosures and some of the fallout of the Navy Yard shooter and, you know, still the Chelsea Manning pieces, this idea of continuous monitoring then, and it was evolving to this new the concept of continuous evaluation. The whole idea with monitoring is kind of looking at information about a person and getting, you know, flags from like computer systems, that kind of thing. Continuous evaluation is getting all this data from these sort of sources that are available that collect information about individuals, and on a regular basis, kind of having this picture of the individual and seeing these red flags that come up, not from what the government can see on its own computer systems, but what it can see, you know, on the whole person that's out there kind of in the public sphere, in the reporting, you know, credit reporting spheres and financial spheres and criminal history and all of that on a regular basis, getting information. And so the whole premise of that came in part because there were these big sort of failures of the system of individuals that, you know, were trusted with information and then did something nefarious with it, either, you know, physically or virtually carrying information or harming individuals. And so you had to be able to figure out a better way to do that reliably than every 5 to 10 years checking on someone. There's sort of that interim time to be able to know if someone can be trusted. But also, as time has evolved, as information has evolved, as the way people live their lives and communicate, you know, like for instance, in social media, the government for the longest time didn't access that, couldn't access that information. Yet anyone could Google it and see that information if you're not doing it in your government role. So the government had to evolve over time. It's made really, really big progress, I think, in its its thinking and its evolution, even in how it calculates risks for individuals and trusting individuals in somewhat of a pretty rational way, I think, now. So we're right on the precipice of big guidance coming out that's going to sort of create the whole, one whole government system, is what the government's telling us, for personnel vetting that creates a better consistent system that has sort of reciprocity and interchangeability and how this process is done. So I mentioned this continuous monitoring and continuous evaluation, and now the government's going to continuous vetting, which is sort of continuous evaluation plus. And it really looks at all the different information the government has, including sort of access to monitoring of computer information, what you're doing on the classified systems, and all of those things, because you sign in as a government employee and you essentially say, yep, I know I can be monitored as I sign into this government system and access this government system. So it is a whole picture. I think the biggest thing is it's intended to create a more reliable system and better efficiencies. Do I think it's going to be a foolproof system? No, I think you're still going to have, you know, people that can get around it or are undetected. And especially in this, you know, first, you know, probably 5 to 10 years of implementing, there will be learning that happens. But that's also why the government's doing it at an evolutionary approach. So there's been, you know, pilots of this continuous evaluation system. And I think we'll still be lessons learned as they move forward to make sure that they can rely on the information that they're getting in a consistent way. One sort of piece I've been trying to make sure we're flagging is we're relying on this information being provided by other entities. So we've got to make sure that that information is either accurate and or hasn't been breached in some way, right? And you're not suddenly ingesting something that you trust when the actual integrity of that information, you know, there's the risk of that being compromised because you're not in control of it. So the government has sort of in some ways a process it's got to make sure that it's clear on that the information it's getting and making its decisions based on is also accurate.
Yes, because you have to curate the right data sources and understand a lot about them. My sure. question is, at what level of privacy can someone who is being continuously vetted and who has security clearance really expect? Because, for example, mm-hmm. one of the biggest known threats to someone's security clearance or someone's ability to maintain the rectitude they need to stay cleared is if they run into sudden severe financial difficulty, say yeah. because of a divorce or some other purpose, they get in gambling debt, whatever it might be, then mm-hmm. the government wants to know that. So there's lots of access to possible credit records, bank records, financial records. Should mm-hmm. that be available to the continuous vetting system for people that are cleared? And where does privacy end for those people relative to where it might end for everybody else?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as someone who's, you know, cleared in government, I used to say, the government knows all there is to know about me, I'm not worried. But the reality is that everyone expects still some element of privacy, right? The government needs to know what it needs to know about you, and you sign on to that when you say, I want to work in national security, I want to have a security clearance. You willingly sort of submit yourself to providing a wealth of information to the government with the expectation that the government will appropriately protect, safeguard that information, and ensure only those in the government who have need to access that information will have access to it. Again, that's sort of where the OPM data breach became so egregious, in that trust between, you know, the employees and contractors and the government and in securing that information. You know, the government sort of learned from that and has a new system for securing that just from that side of things. But yes, even within the government, making sure that only people that need to have access to that information can have access to it, that it is appropriately protected. The government has focused on that for a long time. It's kind of part of the pillar of how all of these policies have been developed and are being developed. So I know it's something that the government is keenly aware of. But yes, as employees, as contractors who have security clearances, you understand that there is at least some level of information that you're giving access to. And some of these things go to these very issues you talk about, some of these personal issues, some of these financial issues someone may be going through. I think the point in that is when the government evaluates that, they should be sharing that information beyond sort of what the need is to determine trust. But two, they're looking at the whole person. So what they're trying to figure out is what was this, you know, what's going on? Is there anything about this that puts you at risk? Is there any of your behavior you either haven't self-reported or, you know, has come up as a flag that we need to delve into further. But all of that goes to the government being a responsible actor in how it executes these policies and ensuring the appropriate safeguards are there, both digitally and sort of, almost credentialing of who has access to the information and for what purpose.
Sina Begley is the Associate Director of the Cyber and Intelligence Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. Hear the rest of the interview after this one more quick break. I'm Tom Temin.
From idea to reality, innovation is at the heart of mission success. At Leidos, we're helping our customers transform vast amounts of data into actionable intelligence. Leidos is number one on the Washington Technology Top 100, bringing unrivaled talent to bear on the intelligence community's critical missions through our data analytics, all-source analysis, linguistics, agile and SecDevOps, and advanced AI/ML that allows you to see the full picture faster. At Leidos, the important work never stops. Visit leidos.com/intel to learn how.
Welcome back to my interview with Sina Begley, Associate Director of the Cyber and Intelligence Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. The last thing I wanted to ask you about was the convergence of physical and cybersecurity. And that has a lot of ramifications. As you mentioned, the insider threat for someone who could be a gunman. And we just had this unfortunate experience a couple of times in the military in recent weeks. And of course, we know they go back, and you mentioned earlier the Navy Yard shooting and so on. Sometimes, well, in a couple of cases, they were foreigners as guests of the military, but more often they are people that are known in American citizens in one capacity or another. And that's one form of convergence. The other is, of course, the cyber controls, the SCADA world over the physical infrastructure that is under cyber control. Where is all that headed, ideally?
Yeah, well, you know what's really interesting? I think the government is increasingly recognizing that and trying to at least bring itself organizationally in a place where it can deal with that a bit better. So, for example, you have components of that and organizations that are intended to deal with these issues. So a really good example is one that was done that happened recently with the Department of Defense, right? With the creation of the Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency, which now merges most of the U.S. government vetting, personnel vetting and background investigations capability with its need to protect critical technology. And ensure appropriate sort of measures are in place in the government, but with, you know, contractors and protecting that critical technology. And then having an underlying piece of this that's informed by counterintelligence reporting and threats and knowledge to make sure that we are protecting what needs to be protected, but we're doing it from a place of knowledge of knowing what adversary capabilities are and knowing what our vulnerabilities are with people and with technology to be able to better secure them. So again, I don't think that there's going to be sort of a solution where this is never going to happen again, but I do think the government has recognized the very issue you're pointing to, and it's trying to posture itself in a way that it's sharing information better and informing itself better to ensure the full spectrum is addressed.
You've been listening to an interview with Sina Begley, Associate Director of the Cyber and Intelligence Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. Find the entire interview online. Go to federalnewsnetwork.com and search Agency in Focus. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Intelligence Community Agency in Focus, sponsored by Leidos on Federal News Radio, a part of the Federal News Network.